Welcome back to episode 4 of Coffee with the Johns, brought to you by an investor's journey. And I am joined today, as always, by Mr. John Barr.
Got a new look. You see this? Trimmed up the
That's
face.
That's right. You did. You lost weight. Got rid of the lumberjack beard.
The man beard. That's sure. That's what we call it.
Man
he's
beard.
He's just jealous because he can't grow any hair.
Well, I choose not to grow hair.
He can grow it, but
I choose not to grow
hair. We all appreciate that you don't. You choose not to grow hair.
Yes, because then I will definitely outstage you at that point. So, welcome back, everybody. A lot of things. This week was kind of dry on the news. Not major news going on, but still enough changes happening in the market where, you know, the whole point of this show is for you guys not to just get the news, but also see trends developing, right? So there's a lot of trends happening right now because of COVID that it's sped up a lot of things in the market. And it's very interesting for you to keep an eye on these trends as we move forward so you see what to expect as far as business, employment, and other data and stats moving forward. So with that being said, one of the first things we wanted to actually cover is realtors.
How are Twinkies today?
Huh? Oh, yeah.
We decided to coordinate today with telepathically halfway across the city. We're like, let's both wear the same exact shirt today.
Yeah, that was good planning on our end. Yeah, for whatever reason, we imagine we have what, like 5 or 6 different types of shirts each. And find the way to wear the same.
It makes it very easy. It's a Zuckerberg approach. We're like, I just have the same shirt in 7 different colors, and every day I just like take that off. And that's when I actually determine that I need to do laundry. I'm like, oh, running out of t-shirts, I'm running out of my prime shirts. So now I can probably get rid of like 80% of my closet and just have like 10 shirts and be just fine.
We actually have J Tank James comments, where can I buy a prime coffee cup? How about this? Bring us a deal and you'll get a free coffee cup. How about that, James? Bring us a deal and you'll get a coffee cup. You don't have to buy one. But yeah, so aside from John's little tangent now about our shirts.
You know people were wondering that.
I'm sure they were. They were really looking at what we were wearing.
Biggest problem.
They're like, oh my God, they're both wearing the same colors. What's going on? What's in the news? So 31% of realtors say they're feeling unsafe. Again, you know, after we finish the talk and everything, all the links are going to be below. But it's actually a very interesting topic. So here are some stats for you from that article that say 31% of people feel unsafe during open houses. 27% feel unsafe meeting new clients. 32% have reported that there's been stolen opioids during open houses. 35% have received threats and inappropriate messages. So, I mean, you know, being a realtor, because especially now with the economy being where it's at, there's a lot of people saying how, you know, everybody wants to become a realtor. There's a lot of people. I mean, you know, friends of my wife and everybody, they want to be realtors. And this is something that's never really spoken about in the realtor space is, you know, the security aspect of it. So, you know, I mean, from your point of view, you are a realtor and you've actually gone to see houses and shown people, like, is that ever a situation? I mean, is that ever a concern?
I mean, it is, because you look at it as, I mean, think about the nature of it. You're meeting this random person that you barely met, if it's a new client especially. Mm-hmm. You're going to a random person's house. Yes, you have a special key to open the door, so there's a little bit of security there, but then you just go into this house because it's on the open market. And, I mean, I've been in houses, some of our own, that somebody had, it was a vacant house, somebody broke into it and was hiding in the house as I walked in. I'm walking around and somebody's like hiding, a homeless person was hiding around the corner inside the house because they just kicked in the back door. It's like, it's just, there's a lot of aspects to it that can be very unsafe, to where if somebody was looking to do some kind of harm, it would be very easy to kind of put your house on the market at an attractive price and then just say like, oh, somebody's going to walk in my house at any point now.
Yeah.
So it'd be very easy to set something up like that. Luckily, I don't think that happens a lot, but it can happen.
Well, for sure. I had reached out to Tim Allum. So if for those of you that don't know him, definitely look him up. He's in our opinion, one of the best realtors in San Antonio, very ethical guy, a stand-up realtor. And he was talking about, I asked him, I was like, what are your thoughts on this? And I mean, to tell you that he sent me back, two chapters of opinions is an understatement. This guy really has some opinions on this. Again, he's a full-time realtor, right? So he talks about how experts say don't lock the door behind you when you're showing a house. He says this way it leaves it open for if you need to make an exit. He's like, but he's been showing houses where he's had either homeless people or drunk neighbors like barging the door, speaking obscenities, making accusations to the people seeing the house. So I mean, there's a lot of things. One of the techniques that he implements a lot is whenever he's gonna go show a house, he tries to get there before the prospective buyer. And check out the perimeter just to look to make sure that there haven't been any break-ins. So he was saying that, yeah, security is it's a very big issue. And it's something that's really not spoken a lot about. So, I mean, I thought it was a very interesting.
Well, I mean, it just looks at it too, to where I know I read the same article that people are starting to more and more people are carrying some kind of defense weapon.
Yeah,
I mean, after that incident for me, it really prompted me. Like, my parents were saying, hey, you should really consider getting concealed carry because some of the neighborhoods we were working in here in San Antonio.
Yeah.
And after that incident, like, yep, need to probably should get on that, even just kind of procrastinating. And that kind of pushed me over the edge to go ahead and get it. And to where I have my concealed carry license, and I do carry a lot of the times just as a just in case kind of measure. And to where I think a lot more people are going to start getting concealed carries or carrying some kind of stuff, because there is some dangers to it. We've all heard the stories of exactly that. If somebody is by themselves going to check out a house and nobody knows you're there, nobody knows you're going there, and you just enter this house to go do a pre-listing or just checking it out or whatever you may be doing, you don't know who's inside that house or who might watch you walk in that house and then somebody follow you in, especially a female. That could be defenseless in that scenario, though. So you really have to be careful to where you have the people that, like the open house scenario, to where like it is a danger. Like if you're and like that's where a lot of people use it as a marketing technique, and it's kind of interesting about open houses, to where people the seller says, "Well, are you going to do an open house to sell my house?" Doing an open house doesn't really help you sell your house.
Right.
Realtors do open houses to get buyer leads, to get potential people that are going to come into this house. And I think they talk about it in that article that it's like open houses really aren't for trying to sell the house. It's just a cheap way to make your client happy and to get potential new clients coming through the door that might be ready to buy here in the next couple months. That's why you have those sign-in sheets where somebody wants to know. They say, oh, we just want to know who's here. Well, they want to know who's there so they can follow up with you later. But then it's also you're holding this open house. And if you have a bunch of people coming in and out of this house and it's somebody's actually living in that house, all of their personal belongings are in there. Yeah. One realtor can't follow four families walking through that house.
Right.
To where it'd be very, especially in these hot markets, you go to like Austin or Dallas or I'm sure some of these other places, these upper end neighborhoods in some of these states, to where if you have four, five, six families, somebody just sits outside, waits till that house is full, and then follows everybody in, finds a master bedroom, goes in the bathroom, takes the stuff, and runs right out.
We've had it in our properties that we go back after an open house or something, and we have shower fixtures missing. Remember they stole the shower heads off of
they stole our shower heads.
It's such a stupid thing because it's difficult to replace like the little pieces that they stole because we had to like buy the whole fixture.
Yeah, you can't buy just the fixture. Like we put it like a really nice dual head shower fixture and everything. And they went to the bathroom and they stole two shower heads of all the things. Like really.
But I mean, it's what they talk about, like they're stealing opioids. So all these things are for people that are having open houses and the sellers still have all their stuff in the house. So it's a real dilemma. And they talk about how 50% of women are now carrying a self-defense weapon and 45% of male are carrying a self-defense weapon. And 72% of realtors have safety protocols that they follow with clients. So this is everything from letting other agents know that you're going to go show a house, where the house is located. Other people having access to, if you have an iPhone, like Find My Phone and stuff like that, like having those protocols in place. And what I found interesting too is that NAR does offer a realtor safety course. And a lot of people say after taking it, they, you know, it has helped them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Elizabeth that she commented, you know, carry permit. And I mean,
she's referring to like concealed carry permit.
Yeah.
Don't carry a city permit that I'm here.
Yeah. I'm
carrying my building permit with me.
Yeah. It's not concealed carry anymore. It's licensed to carry because it doesn't have to be concealed. It could be showed and everything. So it's licensed to carry.
Especially here in Texas. Got the yeehaw.
Yes, sir.
The old school six shooter on my hip.
So the whole point of this whole realtor safety and everything is don't be a victim, right? Like a lot of people, you know, you become a victim of things. And that's the whole point of carrying a weapon on you is, I believe very firmly, I heard it from Robert Kiyosaki like 10 years ago or something, but he said, when seconds matters, help is hours away, right? So in a situation like that, I'm not saying that the quote originated from him, that's just who I remember hearing it from. You're a realtor, it doesn't matter really if you're a female or a male. I mean, you know, Tim Allums is not the biggest guy either. I mean, I'm sure he can be overpowered, you know, no offense, sir. But it doesn't matter whether you're a male or a female. It's just you don't know who can break in, who's going to be in the house. That house that we had that you were talking about that was abandoned, it was vacant, and there was a homeless person in there. You don't know if they're drugged up, if they have, a pipe or a weapon on them. And if something happens, what are you going to do, right? Like, you're going to call the cops and what, hope for the best that somebody gets there in time?
Oh, in that scenario, like, if it would have been anybody else, it was just a female, and she was more scared than I was.
Oh, just the female.
But if that scenario, like, if she would have had a man there with her, and I scared her, and, like, I was preoccupied with that, and he came up behind me, and my keys, my phone, everything like that, nobody knew I was there.
No.
I mean, eventually, I'm sure you would have figured out, like, nobody's heard from him in a day and a half. Like, well, he was going to look at his house. But, and then it also comes to, like, think a little bit.
Yeah.
If you're holding an open house for your clients or your realtors open having a house and you know you have valuables in the house, take the damn things out of the house. Lock them in a safe. Mm-hmm. For one, if you have opioids and prescription medications like that, especially if you have kids, like, they shouldn't just be sitting in your medicine drawer. They should be locked away in a cabinet. And if you're not currently needing them or using them, go take them to a CVS and return them, dispose of them. Don't flush them or anything like that. It's like the worst thing you can do.
Yeah.
But take them with you. You shouldn't have old prescriptions sitting there like that, especially something that's I keep wanting to say like class act, but it's monitored drug. Schedule 1, it's like a Schedule 1 narcotic. There's something like that. Yeah. Where like they're controlled and you really need
control substance.
There you go. Yeah. Controlled substance. That's the word I was looking for. That shouldn't be sitting around your house.
I just got a few of those.
Somebody had back surgery earlier this week. So,
damn, putting out my news.
Well, you don't talk about it.
But one last tip, though, from Mr. Tim Allums, I thought was really good. He says that he never shows an unrepresented buyer who calls him off the real estate sign. He never shows the property unless they email him proof of funds or a pre-qualification letter, because in his eyes is that it's exactly that. Like, anybody can find a realtor sign, right, on a house. It's vacant. And call the realtor, and now it's just you and the realtor. That's it, in a vacant property. Like, I mean, you know, you go to nice neighborhoods or whatever, you know, the house is furnished. I mean, you can do whatever you want. So if the realtor doesn't take that initiative to say, hey, I need to protect this property, I need to protect myself,
mm-hmm.
you know, and somebody just off a sign says, hey, I want to come look at the house. Well, take the time to be like, well, who are you? You know, you can even ask for, I don't know if, I mean, realtors have so many stupid rules, but I would ask, like, can I get a picture of your driver's license? you know, proof of funds? Have you even gotten pre-qualified? Like, I'm not even going to waste my time showing you a house that you can't even afford. No, right?
Especially in San Antonio, like you got a listing 20 miles away. It's like, I'm not going to drive all the way over there. Like, let's vet this person a little bit and see who they are and how serious they are. Because I mean, God, like even if I'm list where I get all the phone calls is if we put a house up for rent. The amount of phone calls and inquiries I get about one of those houses, it's just mind-boggling to where, like, I'm not going to get it. Can I schedule a showing? How about we pre-qualify you a little bit before I spend an hour of my day driving out there to...
Elizabeth puts, when I'm working on at our rentals by myself, I also bring our dogs for company and for deterrent / bark alarm. I hope you have some decent-sized dogs, and you're not bringing a little poodle and a chihuahua.
I'm sorry. Chihuahuas are some of the loudest, most annoying barking dogs. Like, yes, they might be intimidating, but you will know somebody's there. Like, they bark more than any other dog I know about. But, yes.
And kind of leading to the next topic is...
Hey, podcast, if you thought that tip was good, make sure you subscribe. All right? It helps. Now let's get back to the show.
Another thing that Tim had brought up, he says... open door. He says it's one of the worst things because if you have the app, you can pretty much access any other properties. Mm-hmm. So he's had it where he showed up to a property and there's been people inside, right? Like that should not be inside the property. So he was talking about how open door is a big issue. Like all these companies that, you know, you can kind of just go view the house yourself and you don't need a realtor there with you or any of that. That becomes also a big issue. And you know, we don't like open door because I feel like...
Well, I mean, let's talk about that for a minute, too. Yeah. Like, the why they're hitting the news is, like, they're merging with Social Capital Hedo Sophia Holdings Corp in a bid to go public. This just blows my mind nowadays because, like, the open door to me is I don't see how they make much money. What they're trying to do is carve out enough of a piece of pie to make profit. Like they lose hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in what, like, and I thought, like, I was like, man, these people really screwed. And they completely stopped showings and buying properties when all this COVID stuff started.
Yeah.
Because they're buying all these houses, especially here in Texas. Like we have high holding costs because our tax rates are so high to where they make money by somebody submitting an offer, say, I want to sell my house, it's worth $200,000. Well, I'm going to put a bid out to Open Door. Mm-hmm. Open Door is going to come in and say, all right, we'll offer you 160. So you're already losing a spread. Then they're going to buy the house, giving you some convenience to move out. And then they're going to list it for that 200,000 and then let it sit on the market and find the ultimate buyer, making some miscellaneous repairs if they need to do that. But yes, it sounds like there's a lot of 200,000, 160,000. But when you move selling costs, holding costs, everything, there maybe, I saw a statistic, they're maybe making like $4,000 or $5,000 profit over the course of that.
Yeah.
But they have to have so much volume. Like they're losing so much money. Like their business model to me and traditional like people that are in the real estate industry, I don't understand like how they're even making money. Now they're bid to go public. So to me that follows this new trend of these companies losing hundreds of millions of dollars, but they're growing so fast, but they're losing money and going bid to sell a whole bunch of stock to make a bunch of money. And they're never going to become profitable,
right?
To where it's like, to me, it's just like, this is just a massive waste of money. And it's some company realizing that it's a holding company that they can buy this company, take it public, get a whole bunch of cash for themselves, enrich themselves along the way. But they really don't care about the end product or stock investor if they're actually going to make money.
Well, they're going to get, I believe they said 600 million cash. That's just what it is now, right? Like that's the thing that kind of annoys me about these companies is that nobody's worried about building an actual business with the fundamentals of business, right? The fundamentals of building a business that's actually profitable, that can sustain itself, that can grow, you know, that has reserves. Like all it is, hey, let's come up with a really cool idea and maybe an algorithm that other people just haven't designed yet. And now we'll get a bunch of investors to give us money. And then we'll use that money to do another round of investing, and then we'll do another round of investing, and then we'll buy a bunch of properties that we're losing money on, but we have the properties, so it shows that it works by just buying properties.
Well, I think it goes back to these, like the Silicon Valley, New York, these like companies that are just like, they understand startups and growth, but they don't understand the underlying industry. Or they just keep pumping money into it. Like, if we just pump enough money into it, eventually we're going to carve out a new market share. And I mean, I do believe that if you pump enough money into it and can fundamentally change the nature of an entire industry, like Uber, for sense, like, but there was an inefficiency in that. And I do think there's some inefficiency in real estate of like how long the process takes, but it's also where like there's so many laws and legalities and so much paperwork and red tape tied to real estate that I don't think they're going to be able to create enough of a buzz to do that. Because especially right now, like if we have a slowdown in a market and you have to hold on to these houses for 6, 8, 10, 12 months, like, yes, right now it's a hot market and properties are appreciating. But if values start dropping and it's taking longer and longer to hold, like at the end of the day, the seller that started this transaction lost $40,000. They're the ones that could have sold their house for $200,000 but sold it for
$160,000.
Yeah. And now in a down market, I see a place that Opendoor can serve. Like, I got to move. I got to get rid of this house. I got to take off. But you still have that huge loss that you're going to take. But I don't know.
This comes from that company. What's the name? Palahapitiya? Jesus. Whatever.
Not American company.
Damn China. Palahapitiya. But this is their quote about Opendoor, right? The company is transforming the $1.6 trillion residential real estate market by combining a superior user experience, streamlined operations, and machine learning to create a seamless digital experience. But none of this says they have a good company. Like, they talk about the tech, right? And all of the technology and the streamlined operations, but like where I get caught up in, and again, it might just be me being weird, but like this shit doesn't make sense to me. It's like the company doesn't make money, you know? And we actually know a few people that work for Opendoor that didn't make it in real estate.
Yeah.
But went to work for Opendoor analyzing these deals.
No, handling the construction of them, the renovations.
Yeah. Doing all that, which they failed in real estate, yet they're working for Opendoor. I mean,
we've walked some of these properties. Like, there's another one, Perch, just sold out to somebody else. Opendoor, I've walked some of these houses, ones that needed some renovation.
Yeah.
And like, dude, like the most awful looking renovation was like, what did you try to do? Like,
because they have those budgets, they got to stick to it.
And it's the worst contractor doing the worst renovations, and they're trying to sell these things for premium prices. And then when you try to negotiate with them, like, you're not negotiating with a person. Like, there's somebody, yes, you're emailing, but they're gonna be like, oh, well, then we'll give you just $500 off, or we'll lower the price $500. Like, there's no real negotiations, like, where it's like they're just taking advantage of an extremely hot market. But after a while, like, if inventory inevitably goes back up and the market kind of normalizes, I don't see how they're going to become more profitable when the market is slowing down.
Yeah.
Like, the only way is like they just got to get better and better discounts, where who that really hurts is the end seller.
Yeah.
And like this company, like, there's just so much, I don't see how they're saying efficiencies. I mean, really, they're building an economy at scale where they're trying, like, I've realized where they're going is like they control the mortgage company, they control the title company, to where if you're selling or buying from them, like, you have to use their process.
Yeah.
So they're keeping it all in-house, to where they kind of are able to take a little bit of money in every single piece along the way, to where I could see them actually creating some kind of viable business there. But at the end of the day, like, what they're quoting themselves, like, oh, we're like the ultimate like flipping company. We buy cheap, sell high. It's like they're going to have to lower that margin to be able to compete, I think, in the open market, and then take little fees all the way along.
Well, that was actually one of the things that Warren Buffett had said years ago. He loves real estate. And he says, if there was an effective way of acquiring thousands of houses, he says, I will be all in. Yet he's not in, right? Yeah. Because there isn't. There isn't a way to do it at scale, because all these companies that we see, they all have the same problem, is the quality goes to shit. So what they try to do is the law of averages, that eventually they just buy enough properties that they hit some good home runs and it helps out for the bad ones.
Yeah.
The problem is that hasn't been the case for them. Their only way out has been raising more money and more money and more money because their properties are all selling at a loss.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah.
Well, I mean, I see these difficult companies being like, who was the one that just filed bankruptcy? It was the crowdfunding.
Oh, yeah.
They're raising money to buy individual houses. And then out of nowhere, they're like, oh, we ran out of money. And that's how these problems, when they have these growth projections, they have to hit them. And then if they don't hit them 1 month, their funding can dry up in no time. And they just, like that, go out of business. But like Opendoor, I mean, they own thousands of houses to where they then now have to offload these things. I mean, the WeWorks is a prime example of what happened there. It's like they were valued like $60 billion because of their growth rate. And then all of a sudden, 1 month they didn't hit it. And all of a sudden they just went under. And within 6 months, they were down to like $3 billion. Because the number of leases.
Right. Because it goes back to the same thing. The underlying business is not strong, which is why I always tell people getting into real estate and everything. It's like, or getting into any business. Build an actual business. You understand? Like, don't follow the fluff. Don't follow. Just because you can get money doesn't mean you should get money. You know, you need to build a business, something that's sustainable, something that can sustain itself, because then things like that happen and you can't survive now. You know what I mean? Because now it's like, well, you've been surviving through propped up capital.
Mm-hmm. Hey, podcast, if you're finding any of this information valuable, make sure you subscribe.
So, well, moving on, an article that was written. It's the 7 insights for landlords on the new federal eviction moratorium. Ooh, said the word right. But the National Real Estate Investors Association, they have 2 attorneys that did the conversation. So if you're watching live, you can see the article. Click on this little YouTube video and watch the actual video. The guys are not the most exciting people to listen to, but the information is extremely valuable. They're very knowledgeable people, and the information they share is really good. And as you can see in this article, you know, you have the 7 points that they're covering. But it's actually a very interesting topic, because what's happening is a lot of people are looking at the eviction moratorium as, oh, that's it. You know, the tenants are looking at it like, that's it. We don't have to pay rent until the end of December, mm-hmm. right? And it's like, no, that is not the case at all.
Knee-jerk reaction that a lot of people took, like, oh, we're so screwed. But no, like, everyone says, like, oh, they gave no protection for, like, the property owners. No, they really did. To where I've listened to several different podcasts and articles about this. Like, it's clearly written that they have to make a minimum 25, they have to make 25%. Which, okay, 25% of the rent, that ain't nothing. But, like, the steps that these people have to go, they have to sign a document. Well, yes, they could lie, that they have tried every which way to make money. They have been affected by the pandemic. They're paying everything they possibly can. They've exhausted all avenues of rent assistance from governments and municipalities. Then, like, they still have to show up to court. Like, if you challenge these things, like, the landlords, like, they still have to defend it. It's not just, hey, I'm sending an email to my landlord, like, I can't pay rent, go and try and evict me. It's not how it works. Like, they actually have a lot of steps to go through to qualify for this thing. So I think it was very well thought out from what I read of not just saying, oh, blanket eviction, you can't do anything.
Yeah.
Kind of like the original eviction moratorium was. And it's still for 3 months. If you don't have 3 months of reserves for your rental property, like, you're in the wrong business. Like, you're running this way too thin of margins.
Yes.
Because, like, even in January, these people have to owe all the back rent. It's not forgiven. So if they, as a tenant, come and say, I don't want to pay rent for the next 3 months, but all your rent still due. So it's saying, like, I'm not going to get evicted today, but I'm going to be evicted in 3 months. To where, what's the point of holding on to your cash and then having to pay it all at the very end? And it's, you have to pay your late fees, your penalties, like, all that stuff still compounds. It's just not due until January 1.
And it's not so much like a lot of tenants have thought, you know, all right, screw it, right? I get evicted. It is what it is at the end of the 3 months. But I live for 3 months free. You can still get sued. Like, they can sue you for the rent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I believe as landlords, you need to communicate to these tenants. And you need to, that's one of the things that I think that we overemphasize and being a landlord is communicate with your tenants. Set them up for success. Don't set them up for failure. And tell them, like, if they're going to come up with something like this, tell them, like, hey, just make sure that these are the regulations, right? These are the rules. Like, it's fine if you can't pay rent. Let's work something out, right? There's a lot of help. There's a lot of government help It's just government help, right? There's a lot of help that tenants can actually reach out to and get for assistance and all these things. But do it the right way.
Well, and also I think it comes down to proper tenant screening and relationship with your tenant. Where, like, a bad apple is going to be a bad apple. If they're going to take advantage of the system, they're going to take advantage of the system. But there's, if you're renting to these people, like, we have several rental properties, and I meet with each one of our tenants. And that's where I think the problem becomes when we talked about earlier, the scale. You're going to find this once you get to enough scale.
Right.
But I think I try to communicate with our tenants. We talk with them. I know who they are, to where if they're truly in need of help and I believe them, I'm going to do everything I can to try to keep them in there, because I believe people are good by nature, unless they're or good or bad by nature, to where I do that pre-screening up front. I communicate with them. I talk with them. I get repairs to them. We have a good relationship with them. And just tell them, like, look, are you really actually facing problems? I'm not going to kick you out into the street. I'm not that money hungry. Like, I'm not in the business to do that. Because if you're being that predatory and you're not working with them, they're going to screw up your property.
So that kind of ties in, because Chris Invest asked, so why you suggest
so
6 months?
You suggest?
So would you
why you
that suggest? Makes more sense. So would you suggest 6 months of reserves? Yeah.
I think 100%, Chris, is like having good cash reserves is very, very important. And it becomes hard. That's why a lot of people, we've run into a lot of houses we walk in and the house is just in complete disrepair. And you can tell the landlord just sucked all the cash flow out of the property, never had reserves to properly repair anything. Because, I mean, you got ACs that are barely patched together, roofs that are patched together, leaks that were just kind of band-aided over. And you could tell they didn't have enough cash reserves. To where real estate really becomes powerful is when you have plenty of cash reserves and you can weather those repairs. Because you think about it, an air conditioner goes out. That's $5,000 to $7,000 right there. And if you don't have that, you're having to pull cash from somewhere else to invest in this property again, to where we're all about creating self-sustaining investments, to where I have enough cash reserves in that property. I never have to put a dollar of my own money back into it again. It's all money generated by the property, to where having 6 months of reserves is good if you have one property. I think if you have multiple properties, you don't need 6 months per property, because now if you have six property with 1,000 mortgages, I mean, you're talking $30,000-$40,000. I don't think you need that much, because you're not going to have all six fall at once. But the lower number of properties you have, the higher months of reserves I would say you would need. So they kind of say, if you got one property, 6 months for sure. Two, yeah. I'd probably still maintain six. If you start getting to three, I might say you could probably start lowering that a little bit. But it's one of the things, you're never going to be mad with having cash reserves.
Well, and then also, like, we talk about why a lot of people, they get into rentals, they get a property manager, and they think they're good, right? Then they're like, oh, passive income. And that's one thing that we always tell people is, like, being a landlord is not passive income.
No.
You know, yes, I'm not talking tax-wise. I'm talking about mentality-wise. Because a property manager, which I strongly feel that we need to rebrand them into tenant managers, because that's what they are. They're not property managers. They manage the tenant. Make sure the tenant is good. You as the investor need to understand the investment itself, right? So you need to understand, like, you know, 6 months of reserves, two properties, three properties. You need to understand, well, who is your tenant, right? What is their qualifications? Like, what is their jobs? What work has been done to the property? You can start, as an investor, start kind of mitigating your risk based on these this information by saying, okay, well, you know, this person has a great job. Maybe they have military. Maybe they're medical, whatever. They're not going to lose their job. Or I've done these level of rehab to the house, or maybe it's a new build, right? So I know that I'm not going to have so much on CapEx to budget for. So now you can say, okay, after 3, 4, 5, 6 houses, 10 houses, how much is your reserve? You can start understanding how much to have in reserves, where it's not 6 months for 10 properties.
And it's also understanding your property, like knowing how old is your roof? How old is your air conditioner? what year was it built? What type of wiring does it have? Holds the flooring, to where a lot of our properties, they're fully renovated, to where I don't need as much in cash reserves for repairs as something that, like one of our properties we bought, we didn't renovate it because it's good enough. I'm keeping more cash reserves for that because I know eventually I am going to need to do the foundation. I am going to need to do the roof. The air conditioner is 9 years old to where as like eventually I am going
to
need
to repair that stuff. One of them doesn't even have air conditioner that we have to put the whole unit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it's one of those like you got to have to understand your property and your tenant and your overall cash position and how much reserves you need. If you're brand new with one property, you're just getting into this and understanding it, I would suggest having 6 months of reserves and continue to build on that till you understand tenant turnovers, repairs. How often do you have to go out there to do stuff like that? Fix just random little things that break.
And I mean, one thing that we've always talked about is if you don't need it. So we're in our early 30s. We don't need the cash flow right now, right? So what we're doing with all of our rentals is just letting that cash flow pile up, right? It'll just let all that money pile up, let it build. We don't need to start pulling it from these properties. We don't need to start pulling it from the accounts because it's like, if you don't need it, this is, of course, if you are more of a passive investor, we're full-time investors. We're in this 24/7 all day long. So we manage our business differently. But if you're more of a passive investor, I recommend, you know, there's going to be times where maybe you don't know exactly, you know, the kind of work that this house may need moving forward. You don't know what the market may bring moving forward. So the more you keep in reserve, the more prepared you're going to be for these situations. So then when a tenant tries to say, you know, screw this, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to pay rent, and you got to maybe go through the eviction process, maybe there's a risk that they start damaging the property, all of these things come into play, it doesn't catch you at a point where you're like, holy crap, now I got to put my credit cards in, I got to take out a loan, because you have nothing.
If you have one property and you're just starting off this and this isn't your full-time business, open a separate bank account.
Yeah.
Let all the cash flow go into there. Let the money continue to go in there and just leave it there. Pretend it doesn't exist to when eventually, inevitably, you do sell that property off or you pay it off. It's like you have an exuberant amount of cash sitting there always ready to go because the last thing you want to do is run out of money or become tight on money with a rental property. Because if you start deferring maintenance, then you start getting crappier tenants. You have ones that you get desperate. And getting desperate with a rental property to get somebody in that property, like that is the worst case scenario. That it's inevitable time bomb where that property is going to get run into the ground. And then you're going to have to sell it to an investor. And if you don't have the payoff and the capital, like it could really hurt you.
And also maybe you do have a great tenant, right? And they did hit some hard times. And now because you're also in hard times, you're forced to kick them out and stuff like that, where maybe if you would have been able to help that tenant out, they turn out to be an amazing tenant that you have for the next 10 years, right? But you didn't give yourself that opportunity because you were too strapped.
Yep.
And that's the problem with real estate, where a lot of people make the mistakes is that they go into these deals, into these investments, strapped. They have no cash. They have no reserves. They have anything. And now you start making decisions based on your lack of funds, rather than what's the best decision for the investment.
Hey, podcast, is this information fire or what? Have you recommended this podcast yet to somebody? Come on, help us out. We put a lot of time and value into this. I'm trying to guilt you. I hope you feel guilty. All right, back to the show, guys.
So we actually have a pretty good question, though. So that was a great question, Chris. Appreciate it. Keep them coming. But we have a good question from Director Dre Day. Director, what movies are you making, Director? How is Prime Homes preparing for the upcoming crash? So that's an excellent question. And it's a tricky question, right? Because we don't anticipate a crash, at least not in the real estate terms, right? We're not anticipating any major crash that we are trying to prepare for.
Or necessarily here in Texas.
In the near future.
Right here in Texas. Where now, real estate is hyper local. Like you really need to understand your market. Like our state is different than say a New Jersey, a New York, a California, a Florida. But then even within our state, San Antonio is different than Austin, Dallas, and Houston. So
directing my life.
I like that.
That's exactly what you should be directing. That's awesome.
The coming crash is like, I do think there's economic pain coming. Mm-hmm. I do agree. But that's why we study so much of our markets and what we do. Like, how are we preparing? We're not taking on massive speculative investments. We're doing multi-million dollar renovations and stuff on houses.
Right.
Like, we're trying to bring product to the market that is in demand. So if you follow some of our content, like our market reports we're doing, like, we stay in those in-demand price ranges of like 200 to like 300, maybe 350 on like new construction stuff. We stay where the in-demand is. So that's kind of like how we're preparing for it, is we're just being more conservative on what we buy and where we buy it and what price point and what zip codes. So we want to stay in very low months of inventory. We want to stay in the most in-demand price points. Like, we're doing a renovation right now. It's like, we're in that 200, 250 price point where there's just no inventory. Where it's in a, over by the medical center, there's in demand right there, to where if we need to dump it, we can dump it.
Yeah. And that's the investing side. And then what we're doing business-wise, Dre, is we focus on our network. And this is something that not many people do, right? So what we focus on, if you haven't already, if you guys haven't already, make sure you check out the interviews I've done, Tips from the Pros, because that is precisely what we focus on. We build our network, we build our strength that way. Because when the market turns, when the market crashes, it could be, this is what happened during COVID, right? Everybody freaked the hell out. We didn't. And a lot of people lost their business. We've luckily done better, right? So why is that? It's not because we're awesome. I mean, that's a huge part of it, but it's more because we have the network and we have the people that when this happened, we reached out. Hey, what are you doing with this? Hey, what are you doing here? How can we expand this? How can we partner here? How can we do this deal? And because of that, those resources, we're able to take on whatever the heck we want to do.
And it's also, we talk to people and like ask them, like, how was the last recession? What did you do? What did you see? What happened? And you talk to people that have seen .com and the last bubble in 2008 and stuff like that. And like, yeah, I think it was Dan Francis put it the best way. He's like, real estate didn't go away.
Right.
It's just you weren't flipping houses and you weren't selling houses.
Right.
What you did is you started doing more short sales. You started working more foreclosures. You started doing more subject twos. So the strategy changed.
Yep.
So what are we doing to prepare? It's keeping our relationships good, watching the data of what's going on, buying in demand, but then also making sure that we are educated with what the processes are and where the strategies go. Because like wholesaling on the general terms, like, goes away. Of this, buy low, sell off, any sucker that'll pay the money will go away. And those wholesalers are going to go out of business. If they can't pivot to what is in demand and understand the art of the deal and what it takes to get the deal done, and have those relationships and maintain a good name in the industry, like, they're going to go away. So that is what we're really doing, is making sure we understand what's going on and keep our relationships good and our skills up to date, and understanding who it is that we can go ask questions to when things change. The people that have saw the last recessions, that survived it. What did they see? What did they do? And if things change, they're your buyers. The big people are the ones that are buying in the downturns. So you need to know who they are and what type of deals they want, so you can take those deals to those people or partner with them on those deals.
Yeah.
So you need to be able to make sure you understand what happens in recessions, what deals are there, and make sure you can capitalize on those scenarios.
As a business, one thing that we focus on, because you have a lot of these companies that have come up over the last 5 to 10 years, that are these wholesale companies, right? That we know them, and they're, you know, they have, I don't know, 10 to 15, you know, employees or people on their team and everything. And they look like they're these massive companies, but they're building a company literally on the smallest foundation possible.
One strategy.
Yeah. But they have no foundation. Like, that's one thing that we've focused on over the past 5-6 years of being in business, is we've gone deep on our foundation, because what we're looking to build is a massive skyscraper. Right. We're not looking to build a little shed. You know, we're looking to build a massive skyscraper. And to support that weight, you need a big foundation. And that's what we do. We focus on building a big foundation. We focus on the trends. What are the stats? What is the news? What is, you know, the market shifting? So kind of tying into Stone, just ask this question. What areas of San Antonio are you primarily focused on right now for each strategy? And what dictates this is, you know, the market update that we do every month, is to analyze those trends, is to analyze how is the San Antonio market shifting? Because where we used to flip properties before, now we're looking at maybe doing rentals or vice versa, right? Where we used to get rentals, now we're doing flips. And if you're not paying attention to that, if you're not focused on becoming a savvy investor by knowing your market, knowing the trends, knowing the players, knowing all that, like you're just, well, you're not going anywhere.
Well, to answer his question, Stone, I mean, definitely check out our market updates because I cover this stuff in there of like where we focus for what. Because we're, it's not so much you ask like what areas of San Antonio, we don't really focus on an area specifically. We focus on price points and what strategies there are for that price point. Where our flips, we try to stay under 250,000 as much as possible, maybe a little higher, but we try to stay under 250. For rental properties, we want ARVs under 200,000. And for new construction, we want under 350,000. So that's really where we're focusing. Where that takes us, I really don't care. Obviously, I want stuff closer to where we live and work. We're up by Castle Hills, the airport area. So we want stuff north side because I don't want to be driving 45 minutes to the south side to do a deal over there when I have enough work here on the north side of town.
Because you also manage the properties very closely. Like we're not hands-off investors. We're hands-on investors.
Yes, and so. They're not saying I wouldn't go to the south side to find a deal. Just the deals where we're working, we're still doing renovations, new builds, and fix and flips. Mm-hmm. So we're still finding plenty of work on the north side of town where we haven't needed to move to subject twos. We don't market for specific those types of deals right now because it's still, we have extremely low months of inventory. Fix and flips are still good. There's still massive rental demand. We haven't needed to shift to your owner finance and short sales.
And there's a massive buyer demand where you usually do the creative real estate strategies when sellers cannot sell, right? Because maybe the margins are tight or whatever it is. But right now, sellers can sell with no problem. So there's no need really, like it's not, and I'm not saying by all means, don't do those strategies. Of course, we all analyze every deal, you know, as best as we can to do the best strategy, but doing subject to short sell stuff like that is not necessarily working right now because sellers don't need, they're not in a rush. They can sell even a beat down house very quickly. But one of the things, Stone, to keep in mind is what we look at is speed of market. So we look at speed of sale and speed of rent, right? And that's what's going to keep you in those areas. We want to know what are the price points, like John said, you know, 200 to 300, maybe 350, based on the market data. It's not based on our opinions. Everything we do is based on data. Based on the market data, what are those price points? What is the average months of inventory? What is the days on market in those areas? Because that means that if we pick up a property, we renovate it, it's gone in a few weeks. If we pick up a property, we do whatever we need to rent it, it's rented in a week or two. Like, that's what we want. Because holding is how you lose money, right? And price drops and all that is how you lose money.
Well, I mean, just back to what Chris asked, of like recommending 6 months of reserves. Well, we buy in the in-demand areas to where when we got something that we need to rent, it's gone like that. I don't want to be holding things wanting 2,000 2,500 in rent. Well, yeah, it's cool to have that. But that means your prices are higher and you're going to have higher turnover to where it takes longer to find that person to where I don't, that's one reason why we don't need that much in reserves or why we do keep it. It's just kind of when a tenant moves out, I can do a make ready. And it's doing those things that we talk about, like making sure your lease is in March, April, or May. Yeah. So that's your most in-demand time when everybody's moving around. So if a tenant moves out, I can do my renovations, get it back on the market, and I can get a tenant in there in less than a month.
Right.
So that there's these little tips and strategies that you can do to offset your risk. And those little things you just find out and know from doing it and or listening to people that are in it.
Yeah, he means us. So no, but it really, the biggest takeaway from this, Stone, is that's a cool name. If that's your actual first name, that's a really cool name. Just Stone. What's your name? Stone. that's a cool name. But one of the biggest key takeaways, Ben, is don't be emotional in real estate. So where do we see a lot of people screw up right now? One of the areas, so we don't have pockets that we're specifically targeting, But we do have pockets that we specifically want to stay away from. And most of these pockets are like the historic districts, right? In San Antonio. Because you have a lot of speculation and a lot of novice investors being emotional because they want to go in and renovate a property like HGTV, right? They want to renovate. And I understand, right? Because if you're renovating a historic home, you should be using the best materials, right? Because you're doing it at a higher price point. You're doing some cool features.
And the best contractors that know how to make those work with those products. Like, you need to.
At least it should be the best contractors. If you can find them, please let us know. But yeah, you want to be in these areas that the data is telling you to be in, right? So that's what we follow. Like, when a lot of people say, you know, oh, what do you like? It's not what we like. It's what the data is. When we first started, the ARV for rentals was like, what, 170, 180 that we were targeting and below. Now it's up to 200 because, again, it's not what we want. It's what makes sense. Where are the rents? Where's the average speed of market? Where's the values that are selling the most? When we were first flipping, we wanted to flip houses under 200. Now we'll go to 350. Because if the speed of market is there, we'll do it.
The demand.
Yeah, the demand. That's what creates the speed, right? So, yeah. Like, there's areas like Alamo Heights. There's areas in Alamo Heights that we just would not flip a house because the months of inventory there, I haven't checked it out lately, but before the months of inventory were like 8-9 months.
But it's also to say, like, we won't do one in that neighborhood. Like, I'll flip something in Alamo Heights all day. If the value is 600, I'm picking up for 100 and only got to put 200 into it.
Oh, yeah.
Or like you analyze the deals differently.
Yeah, your margins are there.
Yeah, you've got to make sure that it's like, look, I think an ARV is this, but if I'm not selling it, I can drop the price until I get it sold. So it's not to say I won't do a deal somewhere. Like to say, like, I don't like historics and I don't like older homes because the margins aren't there.
Yeah.
Would I do one? For sure, if the margins are there. If I saw a huge profit margin and I have room for air, and I have room to, if the market changes or I don't want to hold on to this thing, I can drop the market. Where you see why we don't like those older homes is people don't realize 100 grand is a lot of money, but 100 grand in a 120-year-old house or 100-year-old house is not a lot of money.
Nope.
Like, you will eat up 100 grand so fast that you'll be at $80,000 and you don't even have sheetrock on your walls yet. And now you're like, what the hell do I do? I need another like 50 grand to finish this house. And then the values have been appreciating. That's made it okay for these people flipping it with that kind of mentality to where eventually you're going to hit a shelf or at a price point, or the market's going to slow down. And then those people can't sell. They can't finish their project. And what this has done is it's put an artificial shelf of what your end seller can sell for at a high premium price to where the margins aren't there. So that's why we don't do them right now. But it's because we have not been brought a deal in a very long time that compensates for the level of risk you have to take.
Right.
And that's our whole business, is we want to be compensated for the level of risk we're taking, which is why we stay to these in-demand price points, because we're able to get at a price, do the renovations, have enough margins onto it that we know they're going to sell quick. So that's why we stay.
And because of the speed of the sell, we can actually sometimes take a tighter margin deal because we know that it's like, all right, maybe this is not a home run deal, but we know it's going to sell for sure. We know it's going to sell fast, right? So it's just another property in the pipeline, where these other ones, it's like, we don't know if it, I mean, it's going to sell for sure because at some point you got to price it, but we don't know if it's going to sell fast. We don't know if it's going to sell for the most, right? So it's like, all right, now we need that in case that doesn't work out. We need that margin built in. And again, I mean, we did a brand new build in Seguin. We hadn't done anything in Seguin yet. First thing we did ever in Seguin was a new build. Why? Because it just made sense, right? It wasn't emotion. It wasn't anything. We looked at the stats. We looked at the data. We looked at everything. It made sense. We just picked up a rental in Seguin as well. It made sense. You know, Seguin, for those of you listening that don't know, it's about an hour away from San Antonio. You know, so most of our investments are in San Antonio, but yet we went to Seguin. So it's just the data. Follow the data. And like Ms. Molly Hernandez says, follow the data. Numbers don't lie. So, you know, they don't. It's not based on emotions. It's not based on opinions. you know, use the numbers, use the stats. So I hope that helps, Stone.
So and enough with real estate. Let's move on to some other topics.
Yeah. So the next topic.
It's been an hour just on the real estate, which we love real estate anyways. But if we want to we want to diversify the session to do not only just real estate, but business and economics and what's going on in the overall news world, society, we'll put it that way.
So one of the next things that's kind of starting to hit the news now is HEB is actually looking to deploy robots to handle the booming delivery and pickup in the pickup business. So they actually partnered. So HEB partnered with Swiss Log Logistics, and they're deploying micro fulfillment centers. And these robots, you guys need to check this out. So let me see. I'm going to put a link to all this here in the description afterwards. But check out like this video of what they're projecting of doing. It's insane. Because that's what it is now, right? How these fulfillment centers work now. In this company, this is what it's proposing to do. This is what they've done. So they've been able to actually shrink down the amount of space that you need and increase the amount of stuff. And then they have these little robots on rails going around and collecting the boxes and everything. And then they bring them to the employees for them to sort them out. So, I mean, insane technology. I mean, this is really crazy stuff, really cool. And what it is for me, this whole information, why I believe it matters, is we're seeing the trends of COVID is speeding up automation, right? We knew everything was going to go towards automation. We knew, I mean, and you know, every area we're seeing it in real estate and everything, but COVID just put everything in hyperdrive. So now, what does this mean? Like, what do you take from this?
I mean, it's just the fact that like technology is not going away as much as people want to fight it, but it is creating more efficiency. I mean, I see a lot of like the Industrial Revolution. They say moving from the fields to the factories, and then from people creating automation like the cotton gin and stuff like that. Say, oh, it's going to take away all these jobs. Well, the economy adapted, and it did change, and we don't have just massive unemployment. While there is a transition, there is a shift. It was eventually good to where it's like people need to be educated and understand like where the trend's going, where are things moving to where like your entry level position of just being a factory worker, like those skills of just repetitive tasks are going away. Yeah. You're getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed like McDonald's. As much like people are pushing for like these $15 an hour wages and they're having all these issues with employment rights. Well, then they just switched to machines. And it's like, so now that position is no longer there. That job is no longer in the economy. Yeah. So like with all these technology, I mean, watch that video and it's just absolutely insane of how smart this stuff is. I've walked through like Amazon warehouse. Have you seen some of the sophistication that goes on in Amazon, how the FedEx, UPS postal services work with these automations to sort packages? It's absolutely mind-boggling. What it creates is more capacity to do more. To where it frees up that person that used to be able to just pack boxes and drive forklifts. Now they can go and find a different job because that's now be taken over by technology and a machine to do that. So now where the new job will be created and you got to stay educated with what's going on. You might have to go get some job training to learn a new skill because that old just I go to the warehouse and I pack boxes and I go home. Like that's going away. It's obviously going away. Especially with stuff like this.
You even have now that they're, I was trying to find the article. I can't recall where it is, but they were talking about how like the new self-driving tractor trailers pretty much are coming out, right? So they're expecting them to come out like rather quickly. And pretty much how it's going to work from the last time I looked into the self-driving trucks is they're going to have the truck is going to drive itself across country, all major highways and everything. And when it was going to be needed for somebody to step in was when it would get into more rural or urban areas. And then somebody will kind of come in like a video game in a sense and drive it from their, I would imagine it's an office, but it could be from home, whatever their setup is. But they're driving it like a remote control car inside the city, right? And they have cameras all around. They see everything. They know everything that's going on. But now it's that's like,
crazy.
It's insane because now this person could essentially drive a bunch of trucks because while they're on the highway, they're automated. And then once they hit the city, they do whatever they need to go. Well, and then
it becomes safer. I mean, you just look at the U.S. military with their Predator drones. Like, these people are in these giant containers halfway across the world flying these multi-million-dollar planes. And if somebody shoots that down, the pilot's still fine. Yeah. Where these trucks is taking people off the road and then it's putting a machine in its place to where if something goes wrong, and as long as technology adapts over time, you're going to have less people on the roads to where if something goes wrong, it only damages automated cars. Okay. So it does make it safer. But there is going to be a transition to where Dre puts on your technology has been taking jobs for centuries, but people have to adjust and realize the basic jobs are no longer a human necessity. And it's exactly what we're referring to. It's like you need to understand that and you need to take initiative and be more educated and go out and produce for yourself. Yeah. And realize that it's not somebody else's job to take care of you because somebody else is taking the jobs. No, it's you have all the opportunities that everybody else has to go get educated, to go to a trade school, to learn a new skill to produce for this economy and provide value to it.
It kind of ties into what we were talking about last week of colleges and all these things. Like there's a ton of resources out there to increase and create more skills and abilities. There's a lot of companies that are hiring people with no essential skills or abilities and training them. So there's a lot of options out there. It's just what it is we go back to being emotional, right? It's not the options people want. They don't want things to change. And I understand, but as technology grows, because again, it's not going away, things are going to change and they're going to change quicker, faster. We'll use faster. So it's gonna change.
I'm just waiting for you to connect the dots. Like, we'll let this go.
But it's good. You know, things are gonna just keep changing faster and what they call exponential growth, right? Where right now it's a few jobs here and there that are getting replaced, but as time goes on, it's gonna be thousands and thousands, you know, within years, and then millions of jobs being replaced because technology is just gonna be going up so quickly. And it's going to be automating people. And it just makes sense. It's not that the companies are these evil, greedy companies. It's just that it makes sense. Like, we're all in this to make money.
They don't do it because they want to because they're malicious. And it's like, no, they do it because there's a demand. Mm-hmm. There's, like, supply and demand. Like, that is the basics of economy. It's the basics of business of why people make decisions.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I love Dre's here. It's a YouTube university for life. Like, my God, the amount of content that you can watch on YouTube, the skills you can learn on YouTube.
Oh, sure.
You can figure out anything here for free. And then if people get scared of technology. Like, I know you are. I am. Excited for some of the stuff that they've talked about coming out to where, like, if I don't have to drive and I just hop in a vehicle and I can do work, I can communicate, I can do stuff, and somebody else, a vehicle takes me somewhere else, that is fantastic.
At like a quarter of the time because all the other cars are automated, therefore it can do like 200 miles an hour on the
exactly.
highway.
Exactly. And we like, Rick, we're perpetual learners of like trying to stay up on this stuff and try to like learn and see what's coming. Like a fantastic book that I read was, I don't know if you ever read it, was Rick Edelman's The Future for Your Money.
No.
It's a quick read. It's a fun read because he just goes through like, I don't know, probably 20 different industries of like what's being changed of like exponential technology is what he calls it and how it's shaping those industries and what's coming down the pipeline for the future of entertainment, of vacationing. It's all tied back to your money and how you should be handling it and make sure you have 21st century investments versus the 20th century investments.
Yeah.
To where, like we talked about last week of like Tesla is, or what was it? One of the oil companies. I don't know. It's some tech stock that didn't have anywhere near the potential for growth. Is like you look at like ExxonMobil was only worth like X billions of dollars, but some other company was worth 10 times that amount and they have the fraction of the profit because it's for the future. So right. Like it's a good book that I think you guys should check out. Obviously, we have get nothing from that. But it is a great book that I read that I think is it was really cool. It's a quick read. And if you like money, you like technology, you like growth and economy, it's a cool book to read and see where things are going.
A better book than that, even though I haven't read it. It's Future is Faster Than You Think.
I didn't like that one as much.
But that one, what's really good with it is that it's from Peter Diamandis, and he's the founder of the XPRIZE and SpaceX and all that stuff. And they talk about all the technology. and the, you know, nanotech and medicine and everything. And when you look at the opportunities that are coming up based on things that are being tried right now, it's astonishing. Like, I mean, it will literally get to a point where I think in the book they talked about by 2050, there's not going to be pretty much any illnesses that can actually harm you, because they're coming out with so much technology that's pretty much can cure damn near anything and everything, you know? So you look at all this and you think about all this, and how is that going to affect you when your lifespan just got increased by 20-30%, your quality of life just got increased, you know? So now you're living longer, you're being healthier, and you have all this automation, all this speed, all this much more time on your hands, you know, that you can do different things. You know, I think it's going to be interesting, because I think with people's anxiety levels of, you know, you got to move fast because you only got a certain amount of time. Like, it's going to be interesting to see, like, when you're flooded with all this opportunity, like, how's that going to work?
Well, I mean, you just can't stick your head in a hole and just be like, oh, I just don't have the effort. I don't have the drive. I don't need this. Somebody else take care of me. I don't want, this is unfair. Like, I think that's a bullshit excuse.
Even Dre just says, you know, it's getting harder for people to be lazy, and these times are making them actually go out and learn something. So they're not making them, but it is allowing them to do it. So right now, yes, you are choosing to be lazy.
If somebody wants to, they can go out and do something. Just like, yes, we talked about YouTube. There's plenty of books, whether it's Future's Faster Than You Think or the Future of Your Money. They're both good books.
Right.
To where there's plenty of stuff out there. If you want to learn a skill, you can do it. You just have to have that initiative and drive to do it. And the world will reward you for it as long as you're providing actual real value to the world.
And that's also the problem, right, with entrepreneurship, why so many people fail at it, is it's truly up to you. You know, whether you succeed in a business, it's 100% up to you. And you got to have the discipline of working, getting up, pushing yourself, making sure you're getting the work done, making sure that everything is working. It's all on you, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why people struggle with this, is because they're used to, you know, they grew up in the school system, listen to your teachers, do what they tell you, you know, do what the school wants, get a degree, go to a good college, listen to them, get a job, listen to your boss. So you're being prepped from an early age that you should not be making any of your own decisions, mm-hmm. right? You, from an early age, listen to everybody else, but don't make your own decisions. You do what they tell you because they know more. So now it's shifting to where it's like, well, we can see that they don't know more, right? We can see that schools don't know shit. They're still teaching, you know, back from the industrial age education. Colleges are not working. Businesses are not a business and automating. So now people are like, well, then who do I listen to? Now it's where the self-awareness starts stepping in, and you got to start actually learning and paying attention and using your own brain and coming up with your own ideas and realizing what is it that you need to be doing next, yep. you know, and not waiting for somebody to tell you.
Yep. Well, I mean, to kind of start wrapping this up a little bit, because I got some stuff I need to do today, as much as we like sitting here bantering. I want to get back to...
Who is bantering?
something Dre said earlier, and I think it's important to... because we each have an opinion on this, as I don't want this to be political, but if Biden goes into office and implements his tax plan, what kind of changes as a real estate company are you guys making or adjusting to? We're not, because until something happens, we don't know. It could go, like, it might be Biden, it might be Trump. As like, but until that happens, you and I've talked about this, towards like, until it happens, there's no point in freaking out and trying to make adjustments, because if you're wrong, now you just wasted time. Because you think about the political world, even if Biden gets elected in November, he doesn't step in until January. Okay, he takes over. He wants to implement all these tax plans. But if the Republicans still hold the Senate, these tax plans are dead in the water. Because the way our government works, one person cannot go through and unanimously change the entire economy. It's like there's a checks and balances. It's like, it's kind of crazy. These guys in a room from 250 years ago actually got this right, to where not one person can just control everything.
They got a lot of things right.
They got a lot of things right. And then, even if the Democrats do sweep and they take all three branches, they can press this stuff through. But we're going to know about it months in advance. And we're going to know the kind of things, like the stuff that we follow, like the show, like, we read up on this stuff. We
do stay attuned to what's going on in
the economy. Even the tax plans, they don't take effect that year. Usually it's for next year's taxes.
Exactly. So, like, we're not making changes right now. Like, ask if something changes, Dre, ask that question again when those things are actually, we think they are going to happen.
Right.
So that's why, like, people freak out, but like, oh my God, what if happens if this person gets elected, and this person gets elected, they change this, they change that. It's like,
yeah.
Well, don't worry about it, because there's a 50-50 chance whether it's going to happen or not. And then two, you're going to see it months and months and months, if not years in advance, of those changes actually coming. That's when we're going to start implementing.
And not just because they want that to happen, is going to happen the way they want. So one of the things that Biden did propose is he is going after real estate investors, which has been our concern, right? And one of the biggest things is that he wants to go after the 1031 exchanges and all that. So he may want to do all these things, but when it comes time to actually doing it, he's going to have to compromise on a lot of things, right? And that could be one of them. It could be that maybe it's not that extreme and it has to come down a little bit, because a lot of times when they propose any of these things, they propose their extreme because they know that they're going to get hit and everything. They got to settle with something less. So we don't know what it's going to look like. And just like John is saying, you know, don't make any adjustments now based on what could possibly happen essentially 2 years from now. Because by the time if he does get into office, he needs to go through all this. They need to get approved. And then a lot of the tax laws and everything go for the following year. You know, a lot of things don't get implemented that tax year. So now you have a whole other year to prepare for all these things. So don't waste so much time, you know, stressing about it or worrying about it. Understand it for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you should
just be aware. I mean, it's just understanding, okay, this is what they're proposing. This is what they're proposing. Like, you just got to understand. You can't stick your head in the sand and just be like, I'm just going to do what I want to do and go. And so it's just really understanding what's going on. And that's why I wanted to talk about this, is like, you just hit it right there. It's like, people get so stressed out about it and freak out so much. It's like, the world's not going to end. It's not going to explode because one person voted a certain way or somebody's in a certain office. Like, the world and the economy is still going to be here. Yeah. It's not going to disappear. Will it change? Will it adjust? Yes, but you can't be scared of change and adjustment. While human nature is like, naturally, they don't like change, but change is the only thing that consistently happens. So you just got to be okay with it, understanding that life is going to go a certain way. You have to diversify your skills, your time, your effort, your finances, everything, to not be so, I'm only going to do this one thing and this is going to be my life. Because then one thing can change and it can take over and ruin your life if you're so devoted to just one thing. So that's where I wanted to get that point across. It's like, don't worry about it. When it comes, we'll adapt and change and move from there.
For sure. And I mean, to finish it up, Rick has a point where he says Bill Clinton made his income tax plan retroactive when he was president. First time in history that had been done. That was rare, but could happen again depending on who gets elected.
It's very true, but there's nothing you could do about it if it happened.
And that's exactly it, right? Like, going back to the same thing, is it's exactly that. We just don't know. We don't know what can happen. We don't know if it's going to happen. At the end of the day, they can do whatever the hell they want, right? And what else are you going to do aside from being like everybody was back in 2016? Oh, if Trump wins, I'm leaving the country, and whining and complaining. And yet they're still here. Like, unless you're actually like that. That's one thing that I love. I want to say it was Roosevelt that said it, but, you know, complaining without proposing any solutions is just whining.
Yeah.
Right. And it's exactly that. Like, if you really are upset, leave. Like, I didn't like New York. I left. I came to Texas. And if all these California people keep coming to Texas, I'm going to have to leave Texas and go somewhere else because they're going to screw Texas up. But I'm choosing to control my life. You understand? I'm not going to sit there bitch and moan and cry about all these changes and all these things and how unfair my life is. You control your own life. You control how you interpret and analyze things. So you're in control. You're always in control. And just keep that in mind.
To kind of wrap up one point with that, have you seen some of these wealth tax plans that some of these states have been putting out?
No.
So they want to tax, all the new rave is tax the wealthy, but I can't remember what state it was, but it was like New York or California or Washington. Like, they're proposing a wealth tax. They're going to tax everyone that's worth more than $30 million on their wealth, just like a certain piece. But then they understand that people, they do that, that people are going to start leaving. They're like, screw this, I'm out. But they are chasing them down for 10 plus. If they leave, there's a penalty that if they leave, and then they will chase them down for 10 more years across the country, wherever they go.
Across the world, not the country.
To tax them to get that wealth, because they said it was made in our state. We should be able to continue to tax that wealth later on. It's like, oh my God.
And look at what happened in New York, where they started doing that shit, and billionaires, like, I don't know how many billions of dollars left New York.
New York, they left for Florida.
And yeah, they all left because of that. And now, because you have Bellagio's ignorant ass that he doesn't understand, you know, how money works. And you have Cuomo now trying to beg them all to come back, because it's like, fine. Maybe you end up chasing them and getting your pound of flesh. That's it, though. That's all you're ever going to get from them. And now you're going to stop more billionaires from staying there. And, you know, like Molly is saying right now, you look at California and, you know, people are leaving. Joe Rogan is leaving.
Elon Musk is leaving.
Like, so many people are leaving California because of that. Because it's like, all right, screw it. Like, if you want to keep punishing us.
And it's not even that. It's like, these are high profile people. Like, all the billionaires left Florida. You didn't really hear a lot of these people, like Paul Tudor Jones and some of these other people that left high tech states to go different places. But now you got people like Joe Rogan, Tesla, Elon Musk, people that, like, Joe Rogan, the number one podcast, gets tens of millions of views, saying, like, I'm out, I'm moving to Texas. And he's saying in some of his podcasts, like, this place is awesome. He's like, I ate so much barbecue. The people are nice. There's less people. Like, people will, like, you have an influencer like that that have eyes like that. They're going to leave. They're going to be like, huh, maybe I should start looking into stuff. Never did. But now Joe Rogan was in L.A., left, came here, and he says it's awesome. Like, maybe they'll start doing it. So,
I mean, even Dre says, because he's in New York right now, he says Billionaire's Row in New York is a ghost town. So, I mean, it's exactly that. Like, that's the thing that politicians don't understand. Like, they always say, we're going to tax the rich. No, you're not. Like, they're not rich because they're stupid, right?
Yeah.
You're going to try to tax them, and all they're going to do is say, okay, I'm going to pick up my toys and go somewhere else. You understand? And yeah, you might hit them here or there with a few little tax bills, but
they're not spending money. They're not spending money. They're not creating jobs. Like, you may tax their wealth, fine, but now they're gone. They're not coming back. And then they're just,
and then you hurt the people anyway, because now the people that those billionaires were creating jobs for, housing for, whatever it was, spending the money there, are no longer there.
Yep.
So now you're creating it into what pretty much California has become, that it's just a bunch of people on the streets, homeless, you know, chaos, riots, you know, a place that used to be gorgeous, now is hideous. Nobody wants to be there, you know, so it's like, yeah, shit doesn't work. But all right, guys, well, that's it for this week's episode. Make sure you subscribe and you know, share it with your friends. I understand that we've gotten some feedback that our language tends to offend some of you. Stop being so fragile, you know, just toughen up a little bit. And I don't mean in a disrespectful way, but like, I believe a lot of people are acting more delicate than they really are. So try to just get some thicker skin. Don't take things so personal. All right. Everything that we put out and everything is for information. I am from New York. I'm half Italian. I'm Spanish. So I'm set up to just disrespect everybody and offend people. I'm sorry, but I don't mean it in any, you know, disrespectful way towards you. Maybe I do. I don't know. I don't care. Stop being so fucking sensitive. Like, Jesus, you know, like, grow some skin, you know, some thicker skin. Understand what your worth is. Don't let me tell you what your worth is. You need to know your own worth. So if it offends you, that's something that you need to look at yourself, why that offends you. All right. That being said, we do appreciate you guys. We love you for watching. We love you for participating. Everything, you know, all your comments, all your likes, all your shares, they mean a lot to us. We do this. We take this time out of our days for you guys. This is not, you know, this is not for us. This is for you guys. We love sharing this. We love sharing this data because we believe if we can all be educated and understand what's happening, we can all work together and create a much better country to live in. So, you know, I hope this helps you guys. And yeah, that's it for this week's episode.
See everybody next week.
Sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Make sure you check out the description for more related videos and links. Thank you for listening, and I'll catch you on the next one.